Okay, without further ado, I'll introduce, after a lot of further ado, I'll introduce Rabbi Rappaport, who was last here 3 years ago. Approximately, we had him here where he gave a talk on homosexuality, and he wrote an excellent book on the subject. If anybody really is interested, I mentioned him because he's become really, I think, in many ways, a world expert on the field, on the dealing with a real problem that affects, many people, often a lot more than people are aware of, and an authentic Orthodox view, a compassionate view. So that's the aspect that I just want to make mention while he's here. Of course, that's not the topic he'll be talking about now, but Rabbi Rappaport lives in London, England, and he right now is running the Mekor Maim Yochaim Institute, which is an adult education institute. He founded himself in London. He has worked for the chief rabbinate. He's an advisor for the chief rabbinate on issues on medical ethics. He's an accomplished young Talmud Chacham, if I can say so. He had the position of the Leeds Kollel for a number of years, and he's been teaching really in London, England. In New York, he teaches a lot, and throughout the world, with his ideas, many of are bringing really a halachic approach to many subjects. And it's a pleasure to have him here to give the Achron Chaviv talk of our conference, the contribution of the Lubavitcher Rebbe to contemporary halacha. Thank you very much. Yes, all three of you watch. And Rabbi Rappaport is tired after a long evening and day, so he will take a seat as he learns, and we'll listen to him here. And my watch is 5 minutes fast. That's on purpose, so I can come on time to wherever I'm going. That's how my watch works. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, although my talk was entitled The Contribution of the Lubavitcher Rebbe to Contemporary Halacha, I hope that it will shed light on the contribution of the Rebbe in general to contemporary Judaism and the complexity in the Rebbe's thought and leadership, about which a lot has already been said both last night and today. First of all, let me make it clear at the outset, that which the Rebbe himself stated unequivocally on so many occasions. He did not consider himself to be a posek, a halachic authority. By and large, he referred questions of serious halachic concern to rabbinic authorities. Ka'atzas Rav Meira Hiro Bepoel, Eimin Yoni Lifsoik Dinim, Yifne al Rav Meira Hiro Meira Tzedek. These are all terms referring questioners to Rabbonim, whose function was Psak Halacha, and the Rebbe was saying, it is not my business to get involved in these things. There are Rabbonim, there are Poskim. And we know that in many of the most serious issues, he did often refer to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, considered by many foremost halachic authority of the 20th century. I remember specifically a colleague of mine in London, Rabbi Shlomo Levine of the South Hampstead Synagogue, in 1982, when there was a large influx of Ethiopian Jews coming to Israel, and there was a controversy about what their status was. Were they considered Jews? Were they not considered Jews? And all sorts of ramifications. So he asked the Rebbe, what is the status, what is the din, what is the Rebbe's view on the falashas, on the Ethiopian Jews? And the Rebbe said, Kvar kosav bozeh hagoyin Moshe Feinstein b'Haparadis. Rabbi Feinstein has already issued a ruling, in which was published then in the rabbinic journal Haparadis, on behalf of the Agudas HaRabbonim, in which he expressed his view. So this is in general terms. Nevertheless, it would be a gross oversimplification to say that the Rebbe did not get involved in matters of halacha. Yes, we may say that these are exceptions to the rule, but there are so many exceptions and reasons for these exceptions that they are worthy of exploration, because they constitute an entire discipline amongst many of the Rebbe's enterprises, and I would like to address some of these today. And I start by quoting a story that I heard firsthand from Rabbi Venerable Chassid Yosef Weinberg, familiar to some because he used to give the Tanya Shurim on the radio on Motzei Shabbos in Yiddish. And he told me a typical Hasidic anecdote. He said that once he had an urgent matter to consult the Rebbe about, and he came back to 770, and the secretary had gone into the Rebbe for the last time during the day, after which the Rebbe would go home, and there would be no further opportunity to give something to the Rebbe, to give a letter in, to give to pose a question. So daringly, he took his letter in which he'd written his question, and he put it under the door of the Rebbe's room, hoping that the secretary would see it, pick it up, and hand it to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe would give an answer. Actually, the secretary missed it, but the Rebbe himself did see it, did pick it up, and gave an answer. So the next morning, Rabbi Weinberg apologized to the Rebbe, saying that he didn't mean to trouble the Rebbe. He was hoping that the secretary would do this, rather than for the Rebbe to have to do this himself. And the Rebbe wrote to him the following words. He's regarding the apology, he writes like an exclamation mark, a question mark. He said, "Haloi kol in yoni is ufhoiben uvifrat vos andre farzen. My entire function is to lift up, and particularly those things which are missed by others." And I definitely think that this also reflects, to a degree, the Rebbe's interference, for want of a more dignified term, intervention, I would say, into certain areas of halacha. Where he saw that there was a matter of halachic concern, that for some reason or other was being ignored, was not being addressed by the halachic authorities, he saw it necessary to formulate a discourse, a sicha, a letter, and outline the halachic concerns, often leaving the I's to be dotted and the T's to be crossed by rabbinic authorities, but nevertheless constituting a rabbinic responser in their own right. And examples of these, I'm going to give you just a few examples from across the board of Eruch Chaim, Yerodeh, Choshen, Mishpat, and Eben Ezer. In the early years of his leadership, he was often asked to give brachas to people traveling to and from Israel. And in those days, people would travel with ships that were owned by Israeli companies. And obviously, he raised the alarm about the fact that these were ships traveling on Shabbos. And that Jewish people, Orthodox people, with few exceptions, were all traveling on these ships without the realization that they are actually participating in a public desecration of the Shabbos on behalf of the Jewish people. And he formulated a number of responsum and became involved in quite a heavy halachic debate as well. In fact, the late Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg wrote a book called Shvisa Sayom, justifying to one degree or another the phenomenon of the Israeli ships. He later retracted his permissive view. The Rebbe's view was then widespread and discussed by authorities across the board, such as Rabbi Feinstein, Diane Weiss of Manchester, and then later of the Eidei Charedus in Israel, and finally Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, all of whom cited the Rebbe's considerations and actually agreed that there was a serious problem. Shavuos, 1978, the Rebbe discussed a halachic problem, a purely halachic issue. He says, "People often have operations and they ask me for a blessing. And I realize that even when these are pre-scheduled operations, surgery to take place a few months later, they often take place Erev Shabbos or Thursday. Now, of course, in the case of emergency, there are no restrictions. But in terms of pre-programmed, pre-planned operations, it was his opinion that there was halachic reason not to do so on Erev Shabbos. First of all, because of the discomfort that the patient would automatically feel on Shabbos, a violation of Oinik Shabbos, but more importantly, because such surgery would almost inevitably involve Chil Shabbos, the desecration of Shabbos, which was neither necessary after the act, and sometimes was necessary after the act, but could have been avoided had the operation been scheduled for earlier in the week. The Rebbe intervened. Another question also that probably came his way to a large extent because of people traveling and consulting him regarding the travel is the shilas that are related to crossing the international date line and the ramifications that has for the observance of Shabbos, Yom Tov, and more, most specifically, the Rebbe's novel contribution, the effect that it has on Shavuos, where you miss or gain a day during the counting of the Omer, and in the Rebbe's opinion, this could lead to the possibility of Shavuos actually ending up on a different day than for the person who crosses the date line, because Shavuos doesn't have a fixed date in the month, but has is fixed on 50th day after Pesach, and this may be a personal cheshbon. This is discussed amongst others at greater length by Rabbi Ezra Shochat of Rosh Hashiva of Los Angeles, and even by Rabbi David Bleich in Volume 5, if I remember correctly, of his Contemporary Halachic Problems. So in all of these cases, and some others that I'm going to mention, the Rebbe sees himself not as the person who should really be dealing with these problems, but stepping in because he notices what one may describe as a mes mitzvah, a halacha that has been left by the wayside. Not enough people are taking notice of this when they ought to be. And so he did on many different occasions, and these occasions he actually formulated entire halachic essays. Sometimes, in other areas, in the 50s, he alerted Rabbonim about the problems that he believed existed with regard to the adoption of children. Whilst he wasn't against imutz yelodim per se, he was concerned about violations of kiruv la'royos, demarcation lines that halakha sets in relationship between men and women that are not biologically related, that may occur as a result of the adoption of children. And although many Rabbonim agreed with him, there were those who disagreed, and again, Rav Soloveitchik is allegedly of the opinion, the late Rav Soloveitchik was of the opinion, that such barriers regarding touching, kissing, hugging, etc., do not apply even in the case of the adopted children. Nevertheless, again, the Rebbe here stuck his neck out because he felt there was something which had gone unnoticed and saw it as part of his mission to restore, if we want to use messianic terminology, the Lahachzira Torah Leyeshna, to sort of make sure there are no halachas going missing from within the Jewish people. And even in cases where he didn't actually get involved in writing anything like a responsa addressing the halachic considerations, but here and there you see him just alerting people. A school teacher writes to the Rebbe about the curriculum and the different things they're going to do, including making an end of the term play show, you know, where the girls participate on stage, and the Rebbe alerts the headmaster or the teacher, saying, "And I'm sure you will make sure that no violation of lo yiyeh li gever al isha, liyulvash gever sim l'sisha, etc., that there shouldn't be any girls dressing in men's clothing, vice versa, a law which has often been disregarded in the context of school plays." One sikha, at the end of 1979, the Rebbe alerted psychologists, psychiatrists, about potential problems in various forms of modern therapeutic endeavor, including transcendental meditation and its association with idolatry. In fact, there are numerous letters where the Rebbe goes out of his way to oppose anything which may have something to do with Abizraihu David Zora, even the most remote appurtenances of idolatry, including the reading of heretical literature, religious education which involves delving into non-Jewish beliefs, etc., etc. Or, in a letter to an ordinary woman, a young mother, who writes to the Rebbe about the fact that they built a swimming pool in their house. He says, have you built a marker? Because although the Bible speaks about a fence around a roof, the policy is that if you have level ground and then a fall, there may be, even not in the case of a house, an obligation to build a marker, a fence, to avoid danger, even if not the actual obligation of a marker, but resosim domin bebesecho, to avoid the danger. So these are some of the examples which I feel fit into the Rebbe's self-perception, as well as perceived by others, as omeid baperetz, standing in the breach, to make sure that shleimus haTorah, the completeness of the Torah, is not in any way undermined. In this capacity, I'm going to actually interject here in order to make things a little bit more interesting with a story, another story, that I actually heard directly from Rabbi Gordon, who was a rabbi in a community in New Jersey. He's no longer alive. He's got many sons who are rabbis. But this happened to him in the 40s when he was offered a position in a small community in New Jersey. And was the case, as was the case in the sort of tepid orthodoxy that prevailed in the United States during that era, there were two problems, one greater than the other. The first was, and this is hardly a problem, but it was an issue, that the bima from which the Torah is read was, instead of being in the middle of the shul, right at the front of the shul. Now, many rabbis wouldn't even bat an eyelid about this problem, but especially in Hungarian circles, this is considered a problem of immense proportion, probably because of a reactionary phenomenon towards reform, etc. But the more important problem was that they actually, the chazan in the shul, used a microphone on Shabbos. So they had a meeting, and young Rabbi Gordon said to them, look, I'm happy to take the job, but I cannot agree to these circumstances. He was a frum young man, somewhat naive, and he said this was not acceptable to him. Anyway, they said, no, yes, backwards and forwards. So he went to consult the Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok, the sixth Rebbe, who referred him to his son-in-law, the late Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the Rebbe said to Rabbi Gordon, he said to him, look, he said, with regard to the microphone, you must take a firm stance, because it is halachically forbidden. But with regard to the bima, he says, don't make any fuss about it at all, and it'll sort itself out. So he went back to the board. Ultimately, there was a meeting between the board and the Rebbe himself, and they said, but there's a Rabbi Brown who says you're allowed to have a microphone, and there's this rabbi who said you're allowed to have a microphone. And he said, look, there are four types of people who discuss microphones and shuls on Shabbos. There are those who understand neither halacha nor electrical technology. There are those who understand electrical technology but have no understanding of halacha. There are those that understand halacha but have no idea how a microphone works. And there are those who understand both. As someone who has both smicha for rabbinics and does understand modern technology, I can testify that anyone who says that you can use a microphone on Shabbos belongs to one of the former three categories. Anyway, so back they went, they had this dilemma, they had a final meeting. The president of the shul, who happened also to serve as the honorary chazan, says, I've got a wonderful idea. If we move the bima to the center of the shul, then there will be no problem anymore. I won't need the microphone. So, chacham odif minavi. Sometimes a sage sees even further than a prophet. Now, I told this as a sort of interlude, but I want to emphasize here that this was yet another area whether I ever saw it his business to get involved matters to do with electricity, reading the Megillah over the telephone or the radio, and all sorts of things like that, where he said, I see from the Shalos HaTshuvos that they don't understand from the rabbinic literature that had been published, that they had some sort of strange conception of how these things actually work, and therefore this fitted into the areas that he felt it was his need to get involved. Okay, now I would like to move on to other areas of his involvement in halakha. I think that one could say that there are areas in which he saw that people were suffering from great pain, great distress, discomfort, and he wanted to ameliorate suffering. So, for example, issues to do with fertility treatment. He would get involved in, to a certain extent, very often mentioning general considerations, of course, to be presented to a Rav Meir Hira, who will in turn issue the verdict. But this is something where he felt that he had to get involved in, just even if only to prod rabbinic concern, so that there should be a ruling in favor of a compassionate psak. The same is true in a letter written already in early as 1952, where he speaks to Rabbi Dubov from Manchester about a patient who was hospitalized for a lengthy period of time, Orthodox patient, and had to have a catheter from which the urine came from the bladder, and some Rav had evidently said that he couldn't daven for a few weeks. And the Rebbe was concerned about the distress that this would cause the patient, and he therefore gave a couple of suggestions for halachic considerations, which should then be taken to a Rav to deal with, who will hopefully give the right pesach based on these considerations. So that's yet another aspect of the dimension. And a third aspect of the Rebbe's involvement in this area. A third area of involvement, and this of course is equally as important, is where it came to the reconciliation between Hasidic custom and halakha. Now, Hasidim, as we heard already yesterday from Professor Schiffman, were accused and were perceived to be indulging in antinomian behavior. Behavior which went against the norms of halacha, at least as perceived, as understood by the rabbinate of their day. Some Hasidic practices later became widespread. Others were even neglected by Hasidim in a later day. But we do find some obscure statements in early Hasidism where there does seem to be the suggestion that halacha cannot always be the final word. The Chozer of Lublin, for example, has this statement, a statement that appears in a number of works of that era, whereby sometimes the violation of halacha is actually the fulfillment of God's word, and statements which were quite alarming, understandably so, to the rabbinate in their day, because of the strong antinomian undertones, reminiscent even of sectarian groups, such as Sabbateanism, that they evoked. Now, the Rebbe, on the one hand, was never expressed himself in this way, at all. He always asserted halakha. Dvar Hashem ze halakha was one of his popular aphorisms. The word of God is the halakha. Giur halakha. Everything is halakha. And he would often alert people. Someone took a photograph of him in Chol HaMoed. Have you asked the rabbi, is it permissible to do so? Would be his response. In his own personal life, he often asked shailos to rabbonim, and a study of just his ordinary behavior shows a great sensitivity to halakha. In a number of letters, he writes to people who have heard things in his name, which seem to violate the norms of halakha, even marginally. The Rebbe goes out of his way to say, if you hear in my name, even from the most reliable sources, who say that they've heard it from me directly, something which contravenes the halakha then you can know that by definition this is wrong. Because I never said such a thing. And I'm guided by the Shulchan Aruch, by the Jewish code of law. On the other hand, the fact is that the Rebbe was an heir to the Hasidic tradition, which observed certain customs and practices, which may be seen, even marginally, to be a deviation from the extreme strict interpretation of the halacha, such as the delay of Zaman Tfilah, the time of prayer, davening privately, biyichidut, without a minyan, in order to engage in contemplative prayer, eating before davening, in order to enable lengthy periods of study and meditation in prayer, and numerous other issues on a day-to-day level. On annual occasions, the Chabad non-observance of the practice of sleeping in the sukkah, and other issues which were often raised by the opponents of Chabad as matters of as manifestations of sectarian behavior, were subjects of concern. And here, the Rebbe used his halachic genius to reconcile and demonstrate that, in his opinion, there may be certain complexities with regard to these minhagim, but that actually, if you study the sources carefully, the minhag not to wash for shalosh shudos, the minhag, many minhagim, many customs that became the norm, and he said that these can be justified even in normative halachic terms. Now, I'm going to move from practice to more the philosophy of halacha. Many of my best friends are modern Orthodox Jews. And we often speak about halacha. We speak about... There is a, as far as I see this, and maybe this is a prejudiced view, whilst modern Orthodox Jews are committed to halacha, they see halacha in somewhat Maimonidean or Aristotelian terms, at least in terms of the guide, sort of very, this is a practical system, a legal code. Sometimes it works against our interest, but we still have to abide by it. And hence you have a phrase that often reoccurs in modern Orthodox literature: we have to operate within the confines of halakha, as if halakha was some sort of prison in which we are incarcerated and to which we have to somehow... this is the price you pay for halachic Judaism. I saw most recently in an article about women writing Sifrei Torah in the Ma'arot journal. There is a sort of course we would love a real religious experience would involve women being sofrim, scribes, but the halakha is a system, maybe outdated, but we are somehow straitjacketed into this system. We live in this time warp, we don't have a Sanhedrin, we don't have a consensus or facility for the change of halakha, and therefore we are stuck within the system. The Rebbe saw halakha in completely different terms. For him, first of all, halacha was ontologically significant. Yes? If something wasn't glatt kosher, it wasn't just a question of how strict you want to be about the minutiae of halacha. It had an effect. It had an effect on your soul, on who you are, on your health. Sometimes if a person was suffering from stomach problems or other, I don't know, gastronomical issues, they would ask the Rebbe. He would say, Yehadeir b'kashrus ha'achila shtiyah. He should go out of his way to enhance his observance of kashrus. We heard last night about shechita. But there are so many different things where the Rebbe, we see that he saw the halacha not being a modus vivendi, a sort of necessary legal system with all its difficult byproducts, but being actually a redeeming discipline. Al tikrei halichos ala halochos, The Rebbe connected halachos olam and halachos olam. The halachos, the law, is a liberating experience. The true fulfillment to a woman, he would say, would come not when she has an aliyah, but when she doesn't have an aliyah. So whereas the modern Orthodox woman may also not have an aliyah, unless she is a member of the Shira Chadashah Shul in Yerushalayim, but she will see this as a great sacrifice of her, of egalitarianism, of her fulfillment, in face of this system we call halakha. For the Rebbe, if it was the halakha and if it had to be observed, then this must be seen as an elevating process, not something which is a concession to this archaic system of law that we are heirs to. Now here we lead on to another thing, which comes back to the paradox element in the Rebbe's writing. If I were to pose the following question, was the Rebbe what they call in Hebrew a shamran, or was he a chadshan? Was he conservative with a small c, and I'm talking primarily in areas of halacha, or was he a chadshan, someone looking for new, you know, breaking new halachic ground? Now, I'm not talking about progressive movements. I'm talking within the halachic tradition. There are those who are bold and who somehow manage to break new ground. With all the orthodoxy in the world, there are mahapechos bahalacha, as the title of one modern book calls it. Was the Rebbe intransigent? Did he belong to the Chatam Sofer's orthodoxy of Chodesh Osam in HaTorah? Or did he... was he progressive? Now, this is a theme which has been running as an undercurrent to this whole discussion. Now, this is a most fascinating aspect because, look, let me give you some examples of the Rebbe's halachic views. In a letter written before he even became Rebbe, he writes to someone he'd just read the response of a certain Rabbi Zilberberg, a prominent rabbi in Pittsburgh. He said, "I was delighted to see that he doesn't get caught up in the web of leniency and koicha de hetera, which has become so dominant in this country." To Rabbi Nissen Telushkin, a prominent Chabad rabbi who sent him his book of homilies, he says, "Thank you for your essay, specifically the one against compromises." What were the compromises that Rabbi Telushkin was complaining about? People having chuppah indoor rather than outdoor. A typical Chatam Sofer issue, raised actually in the response of the Chatam Sofer, and very much symptomatic of Hungarian Orthodoxy. What did the Rebbe hold about shaving beards, for example? Okay, he was the heir to a particular tradition, both Kabbalistic and Halachic, because the Tzemach Tzedek was against it. But whereas other rabbis today have justified removing the facial hair in one way or another, the Rebbe was adamantly against it. Cholav Akum, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Soloveitchik, and others were able to justify drinking milk that had not been supervised. The Rebbe, this was not on. And again, there are mystical ideas of Cholav Akum not only being halachically problematic, but unsupervised milk contaminating the mind and the heart, and even in generating sefekos in amunah, doubts in faith. But there is a strong chodosh osam in HaTorah element. When Rav Zevin sent the Rebbe his book, Lo'ir HaHalocha, in which he speaks about the Shemitah controversy, current to this year, and the Heta Mechira, the question of selling the land, the Rebbe comments, he's not satisfied. He says, "You don't give enough weight to the views that dismiss the Heta Mechira as being unsubstantiated." When it comes to issues of circumcision, matzitsa, modern issue, clamps used in Mila, again, the Rebbe always, as I can see from his letters, took the anti-modern view, what may be described as an anti-modern view. When it came to questions in the state of Israel, Shirut Lu'umi, I'm not even talking about girls going into the army, but girls going into some sort of national service, the Rebbe was against it. Whereas Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg debated whether abortion, therapeutic abortion, is tantamount to murder or a much lesser crime and therefore may be justified in the case of, for example, Tay Sachs babies, Ramosha taking the harsh view, the hard view that it is tantamount to actual murder, homicide, and Rabbi Waldenberg taking a much softer view, the Rebbe refers unequivocally to abortion as murder. Issues of innovation in Israel. The idea to make a Sanhedrin or a pseudo-Sanhedrin or a Me'ain Sanhedrin. The ideas, modern Israeli ideas, planting trees in Israel. The innovation of new prayers, new editions of Nachem on Tisha B'Av, etc., 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 which were accepted by many forward-thinking rabbis, as they are so known, were rejected by the Rebbe. And whilst there are issues here which relate to his philosophy, which relate to his which relate to Kabbalism as well, there is a strong sense of Chodosh Osam in the Torah and a strong ideological stance of Al Titosh Torah Semecha, do not deviate, the idea that we're familiar with from the Hungarian Poskim, that anything new is bad until proven good. And yet, this is one side of the story. And before I go any further, and the same is true on theological issues when it comes to science and Torah. Is the world older than 5,000 years and so many years? The Rebbe was, no, we must take the account in Genesis literally, and so on. The nature of Agada, something which Rabbi Naor spoke about, whilst the Rebbe didn't insist on literal interpretation of Agada, but he did insist that Agada is an integral part of Torah Shebal Peh, and was adamant about that. Minhag Yisrael was of tantamount importance. So there is a strong conservative element, but there were areas in which the Rebbe came across as an extreme revolutionary, even to the dismay of many of his opponents. Now, some of these don't really have halachic implications, but some do. Some do. So, okay, for example, the Rebbe was a pioneer in the area of teaching Torah to non-Jews. He believed that as Jewish people, we have a mission to teach Torah to non-Jews. When the Rebbe first spoke about it, this was the subject of much ridicule amongst his opponents. Nor das felt and so, you know, this is all we're lacking now to get involved with the goyim, you know, that they should keep the Shevah Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. And there were all sorts of snide remarks made about, you know, the Bavitch now becoming a religion for goyim. And the general feeling was, you know, the Holocaust has taught us what goyim are about, and we don't want to know about them, and the further they stay away from us, the better. The Rebbe was interested that goyim should say a daily prayer, or at least observe a moment of silence in the public school, and that this was important, that we took a leading role in teaching Shevah Mitzvahs B'nei Noach to goyim. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein also wrote a response about goyim davening, and he actually says that they are really obliged to daven. But he says all these in yonim, Ein li yirei Hashem li hisarig b'hem. This is not for frum Jews to get involved in government policy or school policy or educational issues. This is for the goyim, you know, am lebodad yeshev of a goyim lo yischashov. He doesn't quote those words, but this is not our concern. So we have the Rebbe as a revolutionary. Now it's true in this area you could argue that there's no halachic revolution. On the contrary, you could say that the Rebbe was restoring, one could argue cogently that the Rebbe was restoring the original halacha, saying that it had been held in suspense over the generations whilst Jewish people were being persecuted by goyim and not able to influence the goyim, but now that we have the new opportunities of the modern world, then we go back to the halacha as codified in Maimonides and as Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Heller writes in his commentary to the Ethics of Our Fathers. If we are commanded to compel the Gentiles in sovereign Israel to keep the law, how much more so are we commanded to use our persuasive powers to influence them to keep the Shevah Mitzvahs B'nei Noach? But, so we have here a whole plethora of innovations, which some of them needed halachic defense. The Tefillin campaign, according to which people would stand on the streets and invite Jews of all levels of observance and belief and the lack thereof to put on Tefillin on the mitzvah tank, raised halachic criticism from the Satmar Rebbe and others. The Rebbe penned response to these, justifying the practice. Traditionally, people who desecrated the Shabbos, and certainly people who were heretics, were treated as beyond the pale of Judaism. The Rebbe adopted wholeheartedly the halachic opinion that excludes modern deviants from this category to make a shenishpu and other halachic formulations, and again met opposition. And I think that with all of these, of course, there was a clear reason for the Rebbe to move to look for leniency, because he felt that here the agenda that was important for him, for the Jewish people, universalism, inclusivism amongst the Jewish people, demanded a halachic concession, or at least adopting the more lenient view where it was necessary. One of these areas in which I think that the Rebbe's innovation led him to some internal tension, and I've shared this with Professor Rappaport before, so I hope she'll forgive me for mentioning it here again. I thought she was going to mention it, but she didn't, so I'll do. Was the area of women. You see, if the Rebbe introduced the celebration of birthdays, or public menorahs, or even women studying Torah in depth, which was new in the Hasidic world, these are things that already either didn't have any inherent halachic problems, or the halachic problems were there were solutions available. But very interesting episode that took place in the 70s. A prominent rabbi now in Israel, the Rabbi of Efrat, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, was a frequent visitor to the Rebbe, spoke to him many times, and he innovated in his shul in the mid-70s that the women should take the Sefer Torah and dance Hakofas. After Simchas Torah, he went to visit the Rebbe and had a private audience. And he says that he spoke to the Rebbe, most of the conversation was about the importance of opening up new avenues of opportunity for women. And he told the Rebbe that he had innovated in his shul the idea of hakofas for women. And the women held the Sefer Torah. And in his words, this is his recollection, he said, the Rebbe said to me, in Yiddish, Nishnor iot gemekta zoiton, iot gedafta zoiton. Not only were you allowed to do this, but you had to do this. He was very surprised at the time. But 2 weeks later, he was hit by a bombshell. He received a letter from the Rebbe, in which the Rebbe says, I'm paraphrasing here, I'm not quoting verbatim, since our meeting, I have reconsidered that which I said in our meeting about women dancing with the Sefer Torah. And I realized that I didn't consider all of the issues properly. And essentially, the Rebbe says that he had made a mistake regarding his ruling. And he says, you are entitled to share this with anyone else, and also to tell them in my name that this constitutes a sincere regret upon the opinion which I expressed when you came to visit me. It would give me great, it would satisfy me greatly if you would write to me to confirm that you have received this letter, because the matter is very much lying upon my conscience. Now, obviously this has connotations when we come to the silly discourse about rabbinic infallibility and the Rebbe's infallibility, etc., etc. But I'm not going to go into that now. That was discussed and will be discussed ad nauseum. But I want to come back here to why I told this story here. I think that when we come to the question of whether the Rebbe was a Shamran or a Chadshan, an innovator or a transformationalist, the word I used last night, or a conservative, he doesn't quite fit into any particular wing, right wing, left wing, or any other. And there is a paradox, or I would prefer to use the word tension, throughout his writings. So yes, young ladies have to go and be involved in outreach work, but it has to be done with darkly tznius and with the ethos of the laws that govern modesty and you know, traditional tznius. The Rebbe wanted to give women a maximum possible role. Nevertheless, he said that if there would be a shul, he wrote in a letter published recently, where they would give an aliyah to a woman, then it would be forbidden for an Orthodox Jew to be there or daven there, because this is a violation of an unequivocal law of halacha. And yet, where there was a question of the Sifrei Torah, which is definitely not a violation of halacha, he had initially strong sympathy with Rabbi Riskin's agenda, because in a sense, this was his own agenda, to create opportunities, new opportunities for women to get involved in the ecstasy of the Torah, in the enthusiasm and the passionate Hasidic worship of joy. And yet, his ultimate decision in that particular case was that whilst the halacha doesn't forbid it, the minhag of Ashkenazi Jews, as recorded by the Ramah, which puts severe limitations upon women holding Sifrei Torah, purely custom, was sufficient cause for him to err on the side of caution and to withdraw his approval or even encouragement and substitute it with opposition. It is no wonder, of course, that, as I said previously, the Rebbe is seen by some as the most anti-modern leader, embracing ideas that I've heard some scientists describe as ideas that belong to the Dark Ages, a young world, an outdated science in the Talmud, so on and so forth. Obviously, the Rebbe, in his wisdom, found ways of reconciling. That's not the point. I'm speaking about the perception of people. And yet, at the same time, he was innovative in so many different projects. And where those projects necessitated it, he was prepared sometimes to push the envelope, even where it came to halachic issues. Just one more point about the women's issues. A letter he wrote in the early years to someone who had interfered with a woman's learning session taking place in the main sanctuary of a shul, saying that it was unacceptable for women even to enter the main sanctuary of the shul. And the Rebbe really blasts him. He says, "What do you mean? Don't you know the Gemara that the women were allowed even into the Beis HaMikdash? And it was only because of the problem of Tzniut that then there had to be a separation, etc., etc." So we have here what I believe, to a certain degree, something that in Chabad lexicon is called the concept of nosei hafochim, the fusion of opposites, or in the medieval philosophical terminology used in relation to God, and no anthropomorphism intended here, but nimna hanimnaos, the combination, you know, the sort of the the of logically exclusive components. This is part of the rich tapestry of the Rebbe's heirloom to the Jewish people. Something which will continue to puzzle many, perplex others, annoy many more, and inspire so many who are no longer enamored with the monotonous black and white pictures often painted by some of the books that are in vogue these days, and understand that spirituality, Judaism, Hasidism, Halacha, and all the persuasions that are related are indeed extremely complex. This is part of the Rebbe's tradition.
It is late. Maybe we'll take one or two questions. We'll daven mincha in 5 minutes across the hall. So we'll make a mincha minyan. Anybody? I'll just ask a question if I may. I'll make it quick. I see. If I wanted to be a cynic,
yes.
I could argue when the portrait you paint of the Rebbe, anti-modern, etc., all the piskei halacha. But he was innovative. He was innovative. One could argue. Only in those areas where it would help Lubavitch. You know, the mitzvah meveals and the tefillin. In other words, he wasn't really innovative. He was anti-modern, but when it was good for Lubavitch, he was good. I just want to, not that I'm saying that, but just how would you answer such an argument?
The Rebbe was the head of the Lubavitch movement, but more than that, he considered himself to be fighting the Jewish cause. And I think that whilst you may hear cynics or sarcastics speak in one way, anyone that I know that had a personal interview with the Rebbe, both from the Misnagdi school or the Hasidic school or the modern Orthodox school, came away, and I don't think there are any exceptions to this, came away with the conviction that the Rebbe's primary concern was Klal Yisrael. And not only Lubavitch institutions, as Jonathan Sachs, the chief rabbi in England, says, the Rebbe encouraged him to make modern Orthodox rabbis in Jews College, in the London School of Jewish, what's now the London School of Jewish Studies, and give them smicha and get them into the rabbinate, so on and so forth. So there is no question, and I know umpteen modern Orthodox rabbis of that particular age who had a similar message. I think that now, the objectives of Lubavitch, it depends what you mean by the objectives of Lubavitch. If the objectives of Lubavitch means that every Jew should wear tefillin because it's a mitzvah to wear tefillin, and because wearing tefillin once would cause them to wear tefillin again, and because ultimately the tefillin will lead to the redemption of the individual followed by the redemption of the world, then yes. But if you're looking at Lubavitch in partisan terms, I think that the Rebbe was the furthest thing from a person whose idea was to build Lubavitch at the expense of anything else, and to make concessions to modernity because it suited the partisan requirements of a particular movement. Very often, actually, the Rebbe could have had many more Hasidim followers, committed followers, had he not made many of these innovations. He lost many potential followers because of his unpopular views. If there was one thing that I personally took from the Rebbe's legacy in my own rabbinate was this, that I personally believe that the Rebbe was uniquely committed to what he believed to be was the truth. And that's why he could never fit into the right wing or the left wing or the middle wing, because he saw all of these as stifling and being contrary to the pursuit of truth. And therefore, he invited upon himself criticism from all parties, not because he wanted or relished the idea of being the subject of criticism and controversy, but because he had this commitment, very focused commitment on the truth,
and would not allow himself to be sidetracked. This was a hallmark of the Rebbe's leadership, and something that I have tried in a very small way to emulate in my own small rabbinate, and also sometimes to my expense, in terms of popularity. The Rebbe's innovations were things that he saw were the need for Judaism. These were what Jewish people needed, not necessarily the Lubavitch movement. His campaign, for example, just to give one example against, about the problem of Giur Kahalocha in Israel, Neo-Yehudi, who is a Jew, and that whole issue, gained no mileage for the Lubavitch institutions. On the contrary, it did everything to undermine the cause and to bring and to purchase for Lubavitch a lot of enemies from people who would have otherwise been very friendly towards Lubavitch. So I think that the accusation, and I'm not saying you're making an accusation,
right,
but
I'm not.
Is totally
I
unfounded.
To yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, thank you all of you, and have a good day, a good week. We'll dive in.